This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Meredith DeFrancesco and Amy Brown for August 27, 2009. Harmful if swallowed, absorbed through the skin, or inhaled. Avoid contact with skin, eyes, or clothing. When handling this product, use chemically resistant gloves. Remove contaminated clothing, rinse skin immediately with plenty of water for 15 to 20 minutes, and call a poison control center or doctor for immediate advice. Do not use in or near a greenhouse. This product is toxic to fish. Does that sound like something you want to run out and dump in a lake? Well, that's just part of the warning label for an herbicide that the Maine Department of Environmental Protection plans to dump into Salmon Lake, which flows into Hatchery Brook in North Belgrade, Maine, in order to kill Eurasian milfoil. Today, we're talking with John McFedrin of the DEP and with Hillary Lister of Maine Indie Media, who's been reporting on this issue. We're talking today about the decision by the Department of Environmental Protection to dump the toxic herbicide Navigate 2,4-D in bodies of water in the Belgrade Lakes region in attempts to address the invasive vegetation known as milfoil. We have with us by phone the Invasive Programs Manager for the Department of Environmental Protection in Maine, John McFedrin. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
We're talking about the application of Navigate 2,4-D, which is known to be toxic to fish, to bioaccumulate in fish, to reduce the survival rates of frogs, earthworms, ducks, and waterfowl, and to present troubling health risks to people, including immune system effects. 2,4-D also has been shown to have high mobility in groundwater and is a high source of dioxin. John McFedrin, what is the Department of Environmental Protection's, what did they take into account in making this decision, particularly as it relates to the effects on other aquatic life and to the year-round residents that use the lakes?
We recognize there is toxicity of this product. We never say that a certain product is safe. Your introduction includes a broad base of potential effects that you could probably spend several days discussing the studies that go into the registration process for this product, which is registered by the EPA. But one of the points you mentioned, Meredith, is toxicity to fish. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are laboratory studies that show toxicity to fish. In the field, the product that we are proposing to use for this invasive aquatic plant infestation is what's called the BEE ester, and it is the ester that is the more toxic form of the 2,4-D. What happens in the field, however, is that this ester is rather rapidly, over a couple of hours, 2 to 3 hours, converted to the acid form, which has slightly to very low toxicity to fish. And really what we look at, Meredith, is besides looking at the studies that have been done, we also look at work around the country with this product, with 2,4-D, in controlling invasive plant growth throughout the country.
Can you talk about that a little bit more? You obviously looked at how it was affecting other lake regions. How were the impacts on actually deterring the milfoil, and what were the effects on other aquatic life there?
Well, I can give you just one. I mean, I can give you, there are a number of examples, but one of them is a project in New Hampshire, Suncook Lake, where 2,4-D was used to control a plant called variable milfoil, which is in the same genus as Eurasian water milfoil, but it's a different plant. And the point that I was going to make about that is I do not hear from colleagues who are doing lake management work throughout the country of fish kills in the field when you're applying this product. So yes, there is toxicity, we don't deny that. There are risks of using this product. There's also the risk of the plant presented and what it poses. And then we make a decision whether we feel like this is the right approach to go. We weigh those risks. And I should back up just a little bit, Meredith, to talk about the general permit process that we went through with the Division of Water Quality Management here at DEP. Through that process, there was review of studies that have been done. It's actually the information's on our website, our general permit. In the general permit, there's an appendix that talks about the studies and work on 2,4-D, and also reference to a review from our Board of Pesticides Control, Lee Bell Hicks, who did a human toxicology review. So all of that was considered in getting an approved general permit for proceeding with, not proceeding with this project per se, because as I talked to you earlier, there's several steps in the process, but it went toward getting the general permit in place so we could consider use of these products to combat the invasive aquatic plant problem.
As you just alluded to, we noted earlier before we were on the air that there is a notice of intent that the DEP presents, and that was approved by the Commissioner of Water Quality on July 30th, and now there's a 30-day appeals period possible where any party could potentially appeal this decision to apply this pesticide to the Belgrade Lakes that we're referring to. Can you talk then a little bit more about this, what is often referred to as cost-benefit analysis? What did you consider? What were your concerns about the application of this pesticide?
Well, our first approach, a little bit of context for Salmon Lake. The plant was discovered August 1st, 2008, a little bit more than a year ago. Our first approach is to contain the infestation, is to increase boat inspections to prevent it from spreading, to survey adjacent lakes to make sure it has not spread. And also, we received a surface use restriction which reduced the use of the cove to prevent from spreading. Then the next thing is, how do we control this plant? Our priority is to control it mechanically. We worked August and September into October of 2008, and then started this spring in the rather cool spring water to try to get the plant under control mechanically, and that is by removing the plant by hand and also laying down what are called bottom barriers on top of some areas of plants to try to prevent them from coming back. Our first priority always is mechanical control of the plants. When we saw in June and July with each successive dive that we were finding more plants, and while we still felt it was controlled to the cove, we had to really seriously consider, again, getting back to the risk question, that here is a very real risk of this plant spreading. We are proposing to treat a 6-acre cove out of a 700-acre lake that has another 500-acre lake connected to it. Downstream, Great Pond is an 8,500-acre lake with considerable areas of potential habitat, areas of, say, 15 feet or less. So we had to consider the risk of this plant spreading to those waters and what it might do to those waters versus the risk of using this product to treat a 6-acre cove according to the label rate, according to, which is an EPA-registered herbicide, of course, and according to the general permit. And those are the kinds of issues that we considered in making this decision on the staff level.
Now, you also mentioned earlier that there has been an application of pesticides in a couple of other instances to address milfoil, though never this pesticide that we're talking about. Can you discuss your experiences with these other pesticides?
This product, 2,4-D, and I will, Meredith, but the product 2,4-D, we, since 2001, since I've been with the Invasive Aquatic Species Program at the DEP, we have not used this product. 2,4-D is used and has been used fairly widely in other states. And we, as a state, get, in our state program, we get requests for treating other invasive aquatic plants in the state. And we usually we do not approve those requests because we do not want to see herbicides being used for ongoing management of invasive aquatic plants. We're using them in this case, we're proposing to use them in this case, because we feel time is of the essence and the benefit of the use outweighs the risk because of what this plant could do if it spread to other waters. But getting to the other projects we're doing, we are using a product called Fluridone. Fluridone is also a systemic herbicide, as 2,4-D is. That is, it does not just kill the foliage, but it kills the entire plant. Using Fluridone on a pond in Limerick called Pickerel Pond, which has the only known infestation of hydrilla in the state, and we're using Fluridone for the only other known Eurasian water milfoil infestation in the state, which is in Scarborough. Fluridome requires a 60 to 90 day contact time for it to be effective. That is the reason why it's not appropriate for use in the situation we have now. We need a product that has a shorter contact time, and that's why we have proposed to use 2,4-D instead of Fluridone. The effect of those effectiveness of those projects is difficult to summarize in brief, but we continue to monitor the response to the herbicide treatment, the response in the native plant community and the non-native plant community.
You referred earlier to LaBelle Hicks doing toxicology work on this particular, back to the Navigate 2,4-D.
Yes.
What were her findings?
Well, I can tell you just a paraphrase from her, let me get the proper title of this, I believe it was her human health risk assessment that LaBelle did in January 2007. In her conclusion, she says that the risk to humans from water treated with 2,4-D in compliance with DEP's targeted rates are primarily acceptable risk range. And I'd be happy to send this to you if you'd like to see it, obviously, it's a public
record.
Great.
How are we defining acceptable risk range?
MOEs greater than 1,000. And again, the detail is in here. If you'd like to see that, I'd be glad to attach that to an email.
And people can see this on your website?
We do not have, let's call it the fact sheet of the general permit, which is in our website. We use information from other studies from other states and the toxicology on the product and what, for example, LaBelle wrote in writing that section. So it references her review. This particular piece is not posted on our website at the moment, but we certainly can post it and make it available. In fact, I think I will because I got to add something else to the website.
Great. In the interest of time, we cannot bring you the entire interview with John McFedrin from the Department of Environmental Protection. McFedrin did say, however, surveys of residences have been made in attempts to obtain water uses. The knowledge about water uses by residents around Salmon Pond. Currently, 3 Spalding Point residents are believed to be using the lake for drinking water. Information is still being sought on well usage and other usages, which will then determine how to instruct warnings. We now have with us by phone Hillary Lister, Maine Indy media correspondent who has attended the public hearing to do with the milfoil pesticide application and has been following this issue and has also been following a biomass issue among others in the state, and we welcome her to the program, Hillary Lister.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So we've just been speaking with the invasive programs manager at the DEP, John McFedrin, and now we'd like to get your perspective on this this proposed, and unless there is an appeal brought to the BEP, this intention to dump Navigate 2,4-D into some of the waters in Salmon Lake.
Sure. I found out about it from a good friend of mine who actually lives in North Belgrade near where they'd be dumping this. She canoes and swims and eats fish out of that lake. She had told me about it. The DEP had held one public information meeting. They weren't actually formal public hearings. They're just informational meetings. The first one they held, she was able to go to because it was in Belgrade Lakes, which is where a good amount of the pressure to be using this herbicide is coming from, but the actual location of where the herbicide would be going is in North Belgrade. And just a little distinction, Belgrade Lakes is much more of a summer colony, vacation colony. A lot of the pressure to use this herbicide has been coming from the Lakes Association, which is largely made up of summer people who are concerned about their real estate values going down if this milfoil spreads to Great Pond, which is connected to Salmon Lake, where they'd be applying this. North Belgrade, you have a lot more year-round residents, and that's where Salmon Pond is located. It's a 6-acre pond, which is connected by Hatchery Brook to Great Pond. And John McFedrin probably went into just the details that in 2008, a summer visitor discovered milfoil in Salmon Lake. This past year, they did some work through hand removal to deal with it. There's also boat launch checks, though, according to people I know who have put in boats on the lake, the boat checks are pretty minimal. In some cases, they don't check all of the boats. They have banned boating in Salmon Lake itself, except for residents of that lake, and there's some concern that there's still boats going between them and other lakes. With the hand removal of the milfoil, there was, at the meeting on this, one person brought up a concern that one of the times they had done the removal, it was during heavy rains and high water, and there's a small dam that separates the Salmon Lake from Great Pond. And the water at that point was flowing over the dam. So there's just a lot of concern that the hand removal hasn't really been done effectively and they haven't closed off the lake. Also in that dam, there's a space for a screen that was put in there in part to prevent sediment and plants from the lake going downstream. That screen has been removed, and despite residents asking for them to put the screen back in to help control this, that hasn't happened. So the DEP sent out a notice of intent in July to put, it looks like, about 600 pounds of 2,4-D into the pond, into the lake, at a concentration of about 3,500 parts per billion. And the warning label on the herbicide says 70 parts per billion is unsafe to drink. 100 parts per billion shouldn't be used on non-target plants. There was a lot of concern about people who use that water supply for swimming and bathing and washing. The DEP said, well, there's currently no warning on the label about that, though one will be coming this next year. But beyond that, they're just issuing a swim advisory that people shouldn't be swimming in the pond for 3 days after they apply it.
Oh, he had said that maybe it was just one day, actually.
Oh, one day.
Perhaps.
Really? Okay.
I don't think all of these have been determined yet on the drinking, irrigation, or swimming.
Okay. Yeah, and just in terms of the safety of 2,4-D, it's one of the chemical compounds that made up Agent Orange. It's a really widely used herbicide. It has a 15-day half-life, but it can be detected in the water, and this was according to DEP, up to 180 days. It can be stored in the sediment and released. The first warning, when you look at the label for 2,4-D, is toxic. It says toxic to fish. There's been a 1994 study by Wang in a scientific journal that 2,4-D is able to bioaccumulate in the bodies of fish, so long after it can't be detected in the water itself, it can be detected in the fish there. And this lake outflows directly into Hatchery Brook, which obviously is a fish hatchery.
Mm-hmm.
And then just in terms of when they're applying it, there's been a lot of concern by people who live in the area because the pressure has come most vocally from summer residents who pointed out at the last hearing we were at that this would be a good time to apply it after Labor Day weekend because far fewer people would be put at risk by this. So there's just concern of who is pushing this and who's going to be most impacted by it.
Did you consider the public meeting, and thanks for the clarification, there wasn't actually a public hearing. Was there a significant attendance there, and what were residents, what sort of, were there concerns being expressed about the toxicity of this pesticide being applied to the water?
There definitely were concerns. That second meeting, the first meeting that happened, people really were concerned about the basic structure of it because they went in there and they were told they were supposed to break into small groups and speak with DEP representatives about their concerns. People said no, they wanted a real meeting where everyone heard the concerns and everyone could express them. A number of people left in the process of deciding how it would be done. They finally decided to do that. At the second meeting, it was a pretty full meeting. There's still probably more summer people than residents, and there were definitely a lot of concerns, also concerns by people who have dogs because 2,4-D has been shown to build up in the bodies of dogs. It's been connected to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. One person raised a concern about also it being connected to higher incidence of Lou Gehrig's disease. 2,4-D, it's the seventh largest source of dioxin in the U.S., and dioxin is one of the most carcinogenic chemical compounds known to science. And then there were just concerns of whether this is even going to be effective. The DEP has been saying that this would be a one-time application, yet looking into other places where 2,4-D has been, or any herbicides have been used to attempt to control milfoil, it's almost always a multiple application. The DEP did use it in Pleasant Hill Pond in Scarborough, or they didn't use 2,4-D, they used another herbicide, fluorodeine. They applied that herbicide, and the milfoil came back full strength. They claimed they didn't know the hydrology well enough, so that was why it wasn't effective. But then the same questions come up here, because when people asked about, you know, what concentration there will be of the herbicide downstream in other water bodies, one of the DEP representatives explained that the in-stream groundwater hydrology is really unknown. When the hatchery stream hits the lake, they don't know what the concentration is going to be, and they don't really need to know, according to the state representatives. There's also concerns that this is going to be applied by a Massachusetts company, herbicide company, so just concerns of where the pressure is actually coming from
Gerald,
for the contract.
Gerald N. Smith of Aquatic Control Technology in Sutton, Massachusetts. Can you talk about the Board of Environmental Protection, the BEP, is accepting appeals from the public, which could then put it into an appeals process right now. It will go forward unless these appeals are made. Can you clarify where that appeal could be coming from and whether we think that will occur and there'll be more of a process here?
Sure. Appeals would be coming from anyone who could be directly impacted by this. So anyone who swims in that lake, boats, eats fish from the lake, or uses water bodies that would receive the runoff from this. So anyone who can show a direct impact by this can send appeals to the Board of Environmental Protection, and they're taking appeals through Monday at 5 p.m. And then they'll be meeting on September 3rd as to whether how to respond to those appeals.
So they will weigh whatever appeals they've got and then decide whether to proceed with more of a process rather than go right ahead with the
correct
herbicide. Hillary, other points that you want to mention in this before we give you time to talk about the biomass issue in Maine, what are some of the crux of the issue here that you would like to bring forth?
Well, this is a very large amount of herbicide for a relatively small water body. It's 6 acres. It's a water body where a number of people do use that water for washing and bathing, for eating the fish. And the DEP has pointed out that they don't see fish kills in association with this herbicide being used. But the concern isn't so much that there will be an immediate result of lots of fish dead, but that these toxins will build up in the fish and in the water bodies, get into people's groundwater, and that the DEP has even stated that this isn't expected to eradicate the milfoil, just to help bringing it under control, but that there are less dangerous methods available to do this.
And again, go ahead.
And that they're just concerned that this is really being rushed forward. They're saying this is an emergency, that they need to do this, and it's really in question whether this really is as pressing an emergency as is being claimed.
We should note that letters of appeal or I suppose any other inquiries can be directed to the chair of the Board of Environmental Protection, care of the DEP in Augusta, and that's where the public can continue to be involved in this. Hillary Lister, Maine Indie Media, let's turn to your coverage of biomass and what's happening in Maine right now.
Sure, and this is actually happening countrywide right now, as there's a real push for more electricity to be produced by biomass, and Maine happens to be one of the states where the biomass industry has had the greatest influence and been a biggest piece of the political and economic scene that we're living in. Basically, in Maine, it's been what the paper companies have converted to. As they make less money using trees for paper, they've been able to make more money by burning trees to produce electricity, and then also converting mills, both for burning trees, also bringing in construction and demolition debris and other waste materials to burn that. And it's been an industry that's depended on government subsidies. It really got going in Maine in the early 80s, after in 78 the PURPA bill passed, which is a response to the oil crisis. It was supposed to encourage development of renewable local energy sources such as solar, wind, small hydro, and thanks to lobbying on the part of the timber and paper industry, biomass was one of the forms of electricity production that also became eligible for those subsidies. And there's actually a big issue then because a lot of paper companies were being able to sell the power that they were producing from their mills. They would sell it to the grid at a high rate since it was renewable energy supply and then buy back electricity at a low cost. They were finally stopped from doing that, but this has constantly been just lobbied for by industry and sustained by publicly funded subsidies. A lot of these subsidies have been on the verge of running out. And so now, thanks to a lot of lobbying on the behalf of the biomass industry, there is a section in the new climate change bill that's now before the U.S. Senate. There's provisions for biomass to be eligible for renewable energy credits and a number of other subsidies because it would be a form of renewable energy. And biomass electricity would include electricity produced by burning trees, burning pretty much any waste materials, construction, demolition debris, municipal solid waste, and also electricity from landfill gas turbines. And there's been a lot of industries jumping on trying to get proposals on the table so they can take advantage of this if this goes through. In Maine, both Casella Waste Systems, which operates the state dump in West Old Town, is working to expand that dump by over 100 acres and produce electricity from landfill gas there. There was also a bill this past spring that would have allowed Waste Management in Norridgewock to expand their dump significantly for the same reason. And in Massachusetts right now, there's at least half a dozen proposals for various biomass power plants. And
in Maine?
In Maine right now, there's a number that are operating, but there haven't been any new proposals immediately. Though this would definitely allow some plants that have shut down recently. Number of them, there's one in Stratton, I think, that has shut down after their subsidies. They were receiving a good amount of their funding from Connecticut in the form of renewable energy credits. And last year, Connecticut changed its classification, so burning construction and demolition debris no longer can get those credits. So because of that, those plants stopped burning it and really cut back on a lot of their operations. If this new federal bill goes through, this would open up millions, if not billions, of dollars of subsidies for this. It's really being pushed for, now there's this new Biomass Power Association, which just announced a $250,000 marketing campaign to, quote, nudge lawmakers to keep tax incentives for companies that turn wood scraps, felled trees, agricultural waste, and other renewable sources into electricity. So the Biomass Power Association is right now ramped up this active campaign to get lawmakers to keep biomass in this federal climate change bill. And the biomass provision was actually introduced by Maine Representative Mike Mishu. Now, the Biomass Power Association is operated out of the law offices of Bernstein Shure, which is the law firm that represented Casella through a lot of the negotiations for them to be able to operate the state-owned dump and also the Red Shield incinerator and provide fuel for the Red Shield incinerator in Old Town. The president of that Biomass Power Association is Bob Cleaves, who's a former employee of Waste Management, which stands to really benefit from these subsidies.
We're going to have to leave it there, but would like to have you back to talk more about this. Where can people go to hear more of your coverage?
Well, there's one site that's very good right now. It's Biomass Buzz at biomassbuzz, biomassbuzz.blogspot.com.